from Michael R. Underwood, author of Geekomancy, Shield and Crocus, and more, comes Genrenauts, a science fiction adventure series in novellas. Fantasy, mystery, science fiction. We know these genres from TV and comics and more, but in Genrenauts, each genre is also a world unto itself, inhabited by archetypal characters and filled with the tropes we all know and love. When stories go off track, you send in the Genrenauts. This team of narrative specialists travels across dimensions to find, evaluate, and fix broken stories, lest the ripples manifest as violence and upheaval in our own world. Struggling stand-up comedian Leah Tang is recruited to join the Genrenauts as stories are breaking at a record pace. Will she adapt to the bizarre and dangerous life of a Genrenaut, or will she end up as just another broken story? From May 9th to June 9th, Genrenauts is kickstarting a Season 1 collected edition, comprising all six novellas. Head to michaelrunderwood.com/kickstarter today to back the campaign and help shape the future of Genrenauts.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
Somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? Get cornered, bash him in the head. That seems to work out.
I mean, what are we, a team? No. We're a chemical mixture that makes chaos.
Gentlemen, I'm Agent Carter. I supervise all operations for this division.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
And
angels of love!
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanti Show. I'm Julia.
And I'm Paul.
And today we have special guest Michelle Baker to talk about her new book, Borderline. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for having me. This is my first podcast, so I'm pretty excited.
Awesome. So Michelle, to start out with, tell us a little bit about your book, assuming that the listener who's listening to this has never heard of it before in their life. What is it about?
Okay, so it's an urban fantasy that's set in Los Angeles. It's about a former film student who lost both of her legs in a suicide attempt and who is currently in a psychiatric facility being treated for borderline personality disorder. And from this facility, she gets recruited to join a secret organization that polices traffic between this world and kind of an alternate magical universe that exists just across the border from it. So that's the basic nutshell version.
So excellent. I'll take lead here. So Michelle, why urban fantasy? What draws to you that as a genre? You could have told this story in a number of different genres, from contemporary to science fiction to urban fantasy. Why did you choose urban fantasy as your vehicle to tell Millie's story?
Well, the fantasy part was never in question, because that has been my favorite genre to read my entire life, and I'm a big believer that you should write what you enjoy reading. So I have always thought of things in terms of magic and wonder and fairy tales. That's just kind of always been my thing. And as far as the urban part of it, it just sort of came out of the idea that I had. I've lived in Los Angeles for 16 years, and the things that I've seen, here, just go so far outside the bounds of the usual reality that it's practically urban fantasy just living here in real life. So it seemed like such a great setting to infuse some real magic, and just it kind of works seamlessly, I think.
Let's talk a little bit more about the setting. So you did set the novel in Los Angeles, and while a lot of urban fantasy is set in much more denser urban cores, Chicago, New York, London, Los Angeles is a very different city. So what, how did you make Los Angeles a character and setting inside of the novel and try to capture what makes Southern California, Southern California?
Well, that's actually one of the things I like about Los Angeles is that it is so spread out. It's like a scattering of small towns over an area rather than one city with a real heart or a pulse to it. You know, there is no, there is technically a central Los Angeles, but it's not really the center of anything. And that's one of the things that I loved about Los Angeles as a setting is that I could take my characters from one part of Los Angeles to another, and it becomes almost like entering another world. There's areas that are so posh and elegant and glamorous, and then areas that are, you know, grimy and graffiti everywhere. And, you know, so depending on what kind of mood I wanted for a particular scene, I could find almost any sort of setting I want without leaving the same metropolitan area. So that was actually, as far as I'm concerned, kind of a benefit of using this city as a setting.
Yeah, so I grew up in Southern California, and I spent a lot of time in LA. A lot of my family lives there. It felt really interesting to me how familiar a lot of it was and how much of this was easy to visualize and easy to sort of feel like I was there, even though it was from a very different perspective from what I think of as my Los Angeles. And I sort of wondered, like, you say you lived there for 16 years, so probably you came as an adult. How has your experience of the city changed over the time that you've been there?
A lot. When I came out here, it was in a situation not that different from Millie's, a very different person in a very similar situation. But I came out here when I was in my early 20s, hoping to make it big in the film industry. I wanted to be, you know, a writer, director, filmmaker kind of person. And that was my first experience of LA. I came out and I was living on the West Side, and I was trying to connect with, you know, film people and learn about screenwriting. And so it was this very high energy, competitive, very social, very treacherous kind of environment, always worrying about saying the wrong thing to the wrong person and who did you need to butter up and who did you need to, you know. So it was quite a different experience from my Los Angeles now as a married, settled homeowner, mother of two, just, you know, trying to find a good school for my kids, taking them to Girl Scout meetings, you know. Yeah, over the past 16 years, it's changed a lot for me, and I've gotten to see different sides of it. Like, for example, now I live more inland. I was on the West Side for more than a decade, and now I've moved closer, actually, to Residence 4, which is not where I was living when I started writing the book 6 years ago.
Interesting. So you say 16 years ago you wanted to make it big in film as a writer and director, but now you're a novelist. How did that change happen?
It was more that the screenwriting directing obsession I had for a while was a phase. I wrote my first novel when I was 10 years old. Like, that's kind of what I've always wanted to do, was be a novelist. But at some point I got it into my head that I wanted to be in the movies instead. And I don't even really remember why. But part of it was also just that I wanted a change of scenery. I'd lived east of the Mississippi my whole life. And at one point I just wanted to embark on some big change and some big adventure. So I moved to LA, which I'd never even seen before. And I think, yeah, it was just kind of a part of that phase where I wanted to have an adventure and try something new. And I'm not sorry that I took that little detour, because it studying screenwriting improved my fiction writing so much, because screenwriting is all about structure. And that was my weakness as a writer before. I just wrote these rambling, you know, sort of pretty sounding things, but they had no movement to them, no structure. And screenwriting cured me of that right away, because you don't get that many words. It's all structure.
Fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about what, for me, really set this apart from other urban fantasy novels. And that's right there in the title, Borderline. Millie is a character who, at the start of the book, has sort of been a year after she tried to commit suicide by jumping off a tall building. She's lost both of her legs, and she's sort of gotten to the point where she's learned how to use her prosthetics, but it's still kind of new to her. And she's also been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, which is also something she didn't know until a year before the events of the book happen. So that's also kind of new to her. And that really, having those things to deal with as she navigated the world, made it a very interesting read in a way that I haven't really seen with other urban fantasies. Tell me a little bit about what made you decide to go with that and how you went about creating Millie's perception of the world.
Well, in some ways, her perception is not all that different from my own. I have the same diagnosis that she does, although I think the basic personality that the diagnosis affects is different. Millie and I are very different people. But we do have the same diagnosis, which means that borderline personality disorder is something that I understand intimately. It's also in my family as well. I've been able to see it from outside. So I know both what it's like to deal with someone who has BPD and also to see it from the inside. But the thing about BPD is that unless you see it from the inside, it's a very hard thing to understand because the outward symptoms of the disorder are so off-putting and so upsetting to outsiders that it's very hard for most people to feel any empathy for someone who's suffering from this disorder. Because it just basically, a lot of the symptoms are very similar to just the behavior of people who are just jerks, not to put too fine a point on it, who just don't care about anyone else. But it comes from a very different place. And so what I wanted to do and was sort of half consciously doing at the same time, I was just trying to tell a cool story, but I was also sort of trying to show people there might be more going on under the surface here than you think. You know, if someone snaps at you or refuses to apologize to you, it might not be for the reasons that you think, if it's someone with BPD. So my decision to represent that was really just because of the long experience I've had with people's complete lack of understanding as to why some of my behavior was the way it was. Now, I have to say for the record that since I've gone through treatment and everything over the past several years, that I've been able to bring my behavior much more in line with what's considered socially acceptable and palatable. But when I was Millie's age, I was as difficult, if not more difficult, to deal with. So I just wanted to possibly foster a bit more empathy for people who are suffering from the symptoms of this disorder.
And I think you really did accomplish that. I was rather surprised because, as well, I think I highlighted this in my review at Skipping Fanny, that this is not the kind of protagonist you generally find in fantasy fiction. So in trying to write a character like yourself, but without any protagonist much like her in fantasy, how do you fictionalize an experience that you yourself deal with day to day, but not make it overly autobiographical?
My solution to that was, as I alluded to before, just making her base personality very different from mine. She is someone who is very bold, very cynical, a bit of a misanthrope. I'm none of those things. I'm shy and sort of optimistic and spiritual, you know, in a way that she isn't. And so I tried taking the kind of person that I sometimes wish that I was, someone a little more adventurous and bold and straightforward, and just sort of layered my diagnosis over a completely different type of personality. And I think that keeps it from being just telling my story, because BPD interacts in different ways with different types of personalities. She is much more likely to lash out in anger, for example, than I am. And that makes a better story when you have someone who is a bit more of a hot mess and a bit more destructive, it gives you more opportunities for conflict, which is always where good story comes from.
Indeed, a more shy BPD sufferer would be much more of an interior life, internal conflict, whereas Millie is very much, when she gets mad, she does do destructive things outwardly, and that does provide a lot of conflict with the characters.
Yes, exactly.
So I wanted to bridge that. You could have just had her as the only character on a spectrum from what most people consider normal, but you have a whole host of characters here in the Arcadia Project. All are not what typical fantasy characters you meet day to day. So how did you build characters like Carol and Tio?
To be honest, I don't know that I could write the types of characters that are typically in fantasy and urban fantasy. I don't know any people like that. Everyone I know, everyone that I'm close to, everyone that I've had the opportunity to really delve into and come to understand their psychology and the way they think has been a mess in some way or other. Most creative people, most of the people that I think because I'm so shy, I tend only to hang out with people who are likely to accept me as I am. And so most of the people that I've known in my life and grown close to have been people who were struggling with either mental health issues or just didn't quite fit in some way. So those are the people I find it easiest to write about. I think it would be actually more difficult for me to write about someone who was just well-adjusted and handsome and perfect and all of those things. I don't know how those people feel. I don't know what their lives are like. Maybe someday I'll, as I get a little more socially confident, I can expand my network and get to know more different kinds of people. But right now, it's honestly just write what you know. And I know a lot of messed up people.
That's awesome. So one of the things that I really liked about this was that you created a really interesting world with the way that fairy interactions with the human world happened, and also with the Arcadia Project itself, and specifically the idea that they're pulling people who are people who have struggled with mental illness, people who are obviously on the fringes of society already. But it didn't make any of that sort of make them magical. It was just these people are better suited to doing the things in the Arcadia Project for various reasons that don't actually have to do with mental illness making you magical. And I really appreciate that, because that's definitely a trope that I think can be really damaging. But I wondered, like, how much conscious effort went into that? And did it just come naturally, or did you think through, like, I'm really tired of seeing this representation and I want to challenge it and subvert it?
I think it occurred more organically. I've admitted in some other interviews that the initial idea came from my husband. It was an idea for a TV series he pitched to me years and years ago. You know, oh, what if there was an organization that was all full of, you know, mentally ill people dealing with supernatural stuff, but of course he pitched it in the more typical way, as because they have some heightened sensitivity, because, you know, whatever that, like, so he was pitching more the magical crazy people angle, which didn't, I don't think I even realized consciously why I didn't like that version of it and altered it and made the reasons for their choosing people with mental illness slightly more subtle than that. But I don't think it was a conscious sense of, oh, I want to represent something different. It's just because I think it just didn't feel right to me as something that I lived and experienced. It doesn't feel like magic to me. It feels like a pain in the neck. So I wanted to present mental illness as more of a manageable obstacle than some kind of secret magical power. But I could still think of, and without getting into the spoilery territory, I could still think of plenty of reasons why an organization like this would seek out people who were a little off the beaten path of society, people that were maybe not as likely to hold more typical central kind of jobs in life.
This might get leading up to spoiler territory a little bit, but it's relatively early in the book. But I almost felt a little bit of a predation on the part of the Arcadia Project in trying to recruit Millie, because they did call her where she was undergoing treatment. And so was that an intentional vibe you were trying to get, that those was like, because it almost feels like Millie feels the same way, that she almost feels like you're trying to take advantage because I'm living here.
I think from the very beginning of the book, yes, I do present the Arcadia Project, and Carol in particular, as having a slightly scavenger-like feel, that they're sniffing around these dark, neglected corners and scooping up the things that nobody else wants. So I think, yeah, there's definitely that feel of it from the very beginning.
So let's talk a little bit about how the world of Arcadia sort of interacts with Earth and our world, because I think it's a really interesting system, and it's very much in line with a lot of other fairy fantasy type things before, but it's a twist that I hadn't quite ever seen exactly, and I'd love to get into a little bit of that, how you came up with it and where your ideas went from there.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. The source of inspiration has always been a mystery that preoccupies me for reasons which I'm sure are obvious. And there was a slightly horrible, actually, thing in a Neil Gaiman Sandman comic many, many years ago that I saw, where somebody had a muse, you know, kidnapped and imprisoned in his basement, and that stuck with me for a long time. But I decided to go with a slightly more consensual take on that, that, you know, that there could be an otherworldly being that by simply touching them you could access a certain kind of genius that was not available to regular humans. What a wonderful fantasy, you know. So, yeah, that was kind of where it started, was just my own frustration with, at the time, the kind of unpredictable and inaccessible nature of my own muse. And then it just kind of developed from there.
Oh, okay, so that actually leads into an interesting question. Because one of the ideas that you play with in this novel is the idea of, with especially with the muse and also without, is the idea of creativity and creation and the difficulties in trying to actually perform a creative act and have that out into the world. And I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about how you drew through that theme throughout the novel, especially in case of Millie, but also with Barenbaum, the director, and his own private studio. And you seem to be going through the entire novel working on, plucking at this theme.
Yeah. Barenbaum is really interesting. I love him as a character, and no one has really addressed him with me at all. But I love the idea of this guy who has a muse, but to really simplify it, basically got so attached to his muse as a person that he kind of tapped out the magical power a little bit and began to lose his own inspiration. And I mean, metaphorically, we see that all the time. We see great artists who, for whatever reason, just seem to lose whatever spark it is that they had when they were young, and they either coast on their past glories, or they get too full of themselves, or something happens and their work just loses its spark. So I just took that idea and made it much more literal with him, that he had literally used up his muse in a sense by just getting too attached to him and to their relationship. So I hope that answers your question.
That definitely answers my question.
Okay. I feel like we've covered a lot of the basics of the book. I really like the way that in Arcadia, that's where the fairies have to go to kind of like replenish their magic. And if they don't spend enough time there, they'll lose it. They'll get too much of like earth in their blood and not be able to be magical fairies as much anymore. And so, like, they can only stay for a little bit of time. I thought that was a fun and interesting thing to bring more tension into the story. Like, you have to make sure people go back and forth. They can't just stay in one place forever. But, yeah, I think we've talked a little bit about a lot of the different things, the borderline personality disorder, the way that all the other characters that Millie lives with in Residence 4 also have some kind of mental illness or some kind of big challenge that's kind of stopping them from being a full member of society in certain ways. Because it's not just that they have mental illnesses. A lot of people have mental illnesses and a big support network and family and friends. All the people that the Arcadia Project picks are specifically people who do not have that. And that seems like it's a good way for them to sort of be invisible to the rest of the world.
Yes, exactly. And also it creates plausible deniability.
Right, right. Because if they talk, then, you know, it's one random person who nobody knows anything about anyway. So why do we believe them?
Yeah.
So yes, I think we've kind of gone through a lot of that and sort of touched on the setting, touched on some of the themes. That's great. If you have not read this book, I urge you to go pick it up. It's called Borderline, and it's out in bookstores now. Everywhere you go, you should be able to find it. If they don't have it, you should tell them to order it. Or you can get it online. You get the ebook version. But if you have read it and you are really interested in having a deeper conversation, stay with us and we'll keep delving into it. But after this point, fair warning to anyone listening, we are going to get really spoilery. So this is your last chance to turn it off, go read the book, and then come back.
Yeah, and this is a book that you really do want to read it through once unspoiled, I have to say, because it definitely changes the experience.
I would agree with that assessment. So, stop now, read the book, come back to us. And now, spoiler territory. And I feel like Paul has a spoilery question just boiling up inside of him. So he should go ahead and ask that.
I have plenty. So I don't read a lot of urban fantasy, but I do focus on several things when I do. And so I focused a lot on Carol and her relationship with magic. And I wanted to ask you, because we have the fairies and we have their connections with muses. Carol is a human magic user, for lack of a different word. So she's a completely different beast. And there's even a fun line toward the end when Millie says, well, I think you could still go in the church because you're human enough to walk on holy ground, which is a really snotty thing for her to act. But I wanted you to talk about how you develop basically her magic system, as it were, and her as a magic user.
Well, here's where I get to be naughty and plug my next book, because it Phantom Pains, the next book in the series, really delves into how Carol became what she is and how all of that works. Part of me wants to just leave it all for the next book, but I also don't want to make you wait a year. So the nutshell version is that she is not by gestation, not by blood, but by her experience of having spent way too long in Arcadia at a very, very young age. She is basically half fae. She is not exactly entirely human. She is a changeling. So she is a creature of both worlds. She has both iron and norium in her blood. And so there is nothing that can be done to make her fully one or the other. And I do explain a little bit more about that in the next book. But yeah, the source of her magic is that she does have this otherworldly substance, norium, just in her blood, and her body is just, it's just part of her, just as it is with the fae. But she is also human, and she also has iron in her blood, and therefore she doesn't have some of the vulnerabilities that the fae do. Her magic is not affected by being touched by iron, because that's part of her. It's not foreign. And so, yeah, she's basically a little of both.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense now. Thank you.
And that's even kind of explained a little bit in this book. Like, there is the point where we find out that Carol's background is that she was basically a changeling and was stolen by the Unseelie Court for a few years as a child. And that when she came back, her parents really didn't know what to do with her. And it was bad.
Yeah.
What I found really fascinating about her was her insistence on compartmentalizing her personality and really like needing to create a magical construct of her emotions as the dragon Elliot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. When she came back from Arcadia, she was a screaming mess. I don't know if you've ever seen videos of or have read about, there's occasionally stories about children that get, you know, raised in basements or something, and they're just barely even human because they don't get these important formative emotional experiences. And so that was the inspiration for kind of the person she ended up being when she finally got rescued. I just pictured someone who was so utterly unable to deal with normal human interaction that there was no choice but to institutionalize her. But Martin, her predecessor at the Arcadia Project, obviously got wind of her and taught her another way to manage herself. And it was meant to be a temporary solution, and she was supposed to be working on ways to kind of integrate these parts of herself. But come on, would you? If you had the option of just putting your feelings away, wouldn't you just do that instead? People ask me all the time, you know, people assume that Millie is the character in the book that I identify with most strongly because we share a diagnosis, mm-hmm. right? But no, it's Carol. It's absolutely Carol. Because to me, that's really the most apt metaphor for a lot of how I coped growing up, was just having a sort of magical place that I could just put everything and not deal with it. But as we can sort of begin to see by the end of this book, and definitely in the next one, that is only going to hold for so long. There's only so long she can get away with doing that. And we're going to find out a lot more about Elliot next book and how that works and the mechanics of it even, too. So.
Ah, I see. Excellent.
Yeah.
I also found it really interesting how much Carol seemed to really look up to Millie as a kind of a role model in certain ways, even mm-hmm. though Millie is a terrible role model.
Yes, but she in Millie, she sees someone who has really messed up emotions and also has some issues around lack of parenting, which were transparent in the film that she made, that Carol saw. That was how Carol came to feel this connection to her, was through her work and seeing this film about someone who was estranged from her mother and, you know... And so Carol sees someone who is dealing with a lot of the same stuff she is, but is actually dealing with it. Not perfectly, obviously, but rather than completely avoiding the issue altogether, the way Carol does, you know, here's someone who is messily but stubbornly trying to figure it out. And so Carol, I think, really admires that.
And you make Carol a leadership figure in this book, and you put her under pressure. Millie's the protagonist. But Carol's got all these spinning plates. She's basically trying to spin the Los Angeles edition of the Arcadia Project as best as she can, and trying to deal with the loose cannon that is Millie, and trying to basically point her in helpful directions, and not always succeeding as well. She says this fear of basically dropping all the plates.
Yeah, yeah. So she needs Elliot. She needs that convenient little carry-on bag for her emotions so that she can do everything that she needs to do, because she knows it isn't just laziness on her part. She knows how much depends on her since Martin died when she was 15 years old. What choice did she have but to keep using that crutch that was meant to be gone by the time she reached adulthood, but then she was given all this responsibility. So, yeah, she had no choice, really, but to continue using that crutch just because everything would fall apart around her if she didn't.
So let's talk a little bit more about Barenboim, because I think there's a lot of interesting stuff we can get into now that we're actually okay to spoil things.
Yeah.
I found him to be a fascinating character. The the sort of shifting perceptions from Millie's point of view of him as being like this amazing, wonderful, like kind of father figure slash directing god, and then sort of the disillusionment and the hints that we see throughout that he's kind of complex, but he actually doesn't seem to be a terrible person. Were you basing him on any real directors? Were you just like making him up out of whole cloth? And how did you decide to make him the way he was?
He's not based on anyone real. In fact, none of my characters are. That's not a thing that I do usually. And mostly because I don't think I could actually adequately capture any real person if I tried. So Barenboim is more, he grew more out of a habitual tendency that I had in my 20s, my teens and 20s especially, and even now to some extent, but a borderline thing of idealization, which is we find someone and we just basically canonize them, you know, we make them saints in our minds, and they're something better than we are. They're above us, and they're just glorious, glowing examples of humanity. And then usually, at some point, the borderline shifts at the first disappointment, at the first conflict with that person. Then the person shifts, and that splitting thing occurs, where now this person is a demon and horrible and has been deceiving them all this time. They blame the person for their own exaggerated idealization, like as though that person had been deliberately deceiving them. And Barenboim is complicated. He is a good guy. He really is. He's not a perfect guy, and he can be deceptive, you know, in the way that Hollywood people are. But as far as Hollywood people go, I mean, he would probably be among the most upright and good-hearted of the lot. But yeah, he is complex, and there, as with all the characters, there's a lot more to him than even Millie ever gets to see, because she's caught up in her own stuff, her own drama. But no, he's not a bad guy, and he does care about Millie. I tried to make it fairly obvious in the book that he isn't just using her, that he really does, for whatever reason, just kind of feel a connection with her and wants to help her out. But he's also just so willing to believe whatever Vivian tells him, or willing to not question the things Vivian doesn't tell him, because he wants so badly to start this studio and to have something that will outlast him even more than his films will. Something living, something that would continue to produce long after he's gone, that would continue to produce great art.
That nicely actually dovetails into a question I had about him trying to start his own studio and the choices you made in making this novel contemporary. It, as a pure accent, I was reading your novel at the same time that I'd gone to see the new Coen Brothers movie Hail Caesar, and I was thinking about movie studios and movie directors and the studio system and how directors fit within that, and how Barenboim is very much a artifact of this time. And I was wondering if you had thought about setting the main portion of the novel, though we get some ideas of how things go back in time, in this period specifically, so that you could explore those questions as opposed to other questions about directors and the Hollywood experience.
That would be a wonderful thing to say that was in my mind, but it was honestly just laziness. I said it in my time because that's the time I know. And at the time that I started writing this book, I was trying to make things as easy on myself as possible, because I had just had my first child. I was housebound, basically, because of an injury, living in this tiny little apartment with a baby. And, you know, so a lot of the choices I made were just what's going to be the least amount of research. So in the case of setting this in the current time period, that would be one of those things.
So you say that you were trying to make things easy on you and not having to do too much research, but you also made your main character a double amputee who had to deal with getting around with prosthetic legs and using a cane and a wheelchair and various things like that. And I can only imagine that you had to have done a lot of research with that.
Yeah, that was definitely...
Tell me about that. Like, how did you go about researching that? Did you talk to a lot of different people? Did you read things?
Oh, I tried my best to talk to people. But the thing is, when you don't have a book out, when you're just a novelist wannabe, no one wants to talk to you about their personal stuff. And I honestly don't blame them. I did reach out to people, anyone I could find, to the point of I would find YouTube videos of people who had done videos of their rehabilitation process. And I tried to contact some of them, just drop them a little message saying, hey, this was really interesting to me. And I was wondering if I could talk to you. No one ever got back to me. So it ended up all being YouTube videos. I did a lot of reading. I did as much research as I could. And I'm hoping now that I have a book out and that I'm not just some random weirdo on the internet, that it'll be easier for me to actually talk to people and get more personal experiences. I do feel ambivalent about having chosen to give my protagonist a disability that I do not have myself, but this came from something that it is a little difficult to talk about, which is that she was the survivor of a suicide attempt, but I had to make sure that her suicide attempt, because it failed, did not come off as just a cry for attention, especially with a female protagonist. If you have someone who has tried to kill herself and not succeeded, a lot of people are going to assume, especially if it's a woman, that it was just a way of trying to get attention. And I didn't want... She's got enough problems with relatability as it is without readers automatically assuming that she's, you know, faking suicide attempts to get attention. So it had to be something that obviously she had every expectation was going to kill her, which meant I had to either go the firearms route or use, you know, jumping off a building. And I'm not comfortable with firearms, so it ended up being the 7-story fall. And the only way you can survive that, you're not gonna survive a fall that is supposed to kill you without massive damage. So I had to damage her in such a way that it was obvious that she miraculously survived what should have been a lethal fall.
That answered the question I had in the wings. Like, why make her a amputee? Why give her that additional layer of disability on top of her BPD? But you've just answered it. You just anticipated and answered my question quite elegantly. And I do see your point. If she had no physical or any visible remnants of what had happened, then it would might for some reason come off as like, oh yeah, she tried to kill herself, but yet she didn't really mean it. By taking off her legs, you gave her permanent stakes and a permanent signpost to the darkest point in her life that is a year past and is an undeniable marker as to what she tried to do to herself.
I'm fully aware of how awful it is that a character is somehow more trustworthy because they really wanted to die. But unfortunately, I've dealt with people's reaction to mental health stuff enough in my own life to know how they would have reacted if she had just say, well, I don't want to get too detailed about various suicide methods, but yeah. So it's a hard thing to talk about because I know how offensive it is just by its very existence that those prejudices exist, but I had to deal with it as best I could.
And I think you did it very well. This was for me a tough book to read. I don't have any diagnosed mental health problems, although as listeners of this podcast know, sometimes I struggle with depression and self-worth and other things. So coming across a character who had tried to kill herself and almost succeeded and has BPD. This was not the easiest of reads for me. It was good, mind you. It challenged me, but it's like, wow. I felt uncomfortable in a good way trying to get to know Millie and Carol and the other characters here, because I could see ghostly reflections in the mirror, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And I've been getting a lot of feedback like that. I've been getting a lot of, this was hard to read, but hopefully in a good way. And I think that sometimes discomfort is the first sign of change or growth in some way, or at least thinking about something that we haven't thought about before. I love books that make me a little uncomfortable. So I suppose, once again, it's writing the kind of thing you like to read.
Yeah, and I mean, I really loved reading it, and I did also find it hard to read. I did find it simultaneously fast-paced and really easy on one level, and on another level, so emotionally hard that I actually did have to pause at one point for about a week. Like, I think I read the first 100 pages, and then I put it down for a week until I was ready to come back to it, because my other life stuff was stressful enough that I was like, I can't be in that emotional space right now. which was interesting, but at the same time, even though I put it down, my interest in it never wavered. I always wanted to come back to it, and I found it a very rewarding experience. One of the things that I really liked about the history of the suicide attempt and Millie's current position and her attitude towards life and the world right now is that multiple times throughout the book, characters ask her, like, is she in danger of doing this again? And she's always very firmly coming down on the side of, no, I understand how horrible it is to everyone else in the world when someone does that, and I will never do that again, and I'm lucky to be alive. And I think that's a really important message, because I know there are a lot of people out there who struggle with suicidal thoughts and ideas, and having a character who's really fighting against that internally and externally is a great thing for people who are maybe thinking that the world would be better off without them to see. So thank you for doing that. That was really great. But what I actually wanted to talk about is going back a little step. One of the things that's interesting is that Millie's fall and her surgeries and her prosthetics and all of that stuff leads to her having a lot of metal in her body, which it turns her into what the fairies call iron bones, because she's got so much metal that if she touches them, it interrupts their magic. It can drain them, or it can just sort of stop their glamour from working while she's touching them or whatever. And that's a really interesting thing for plot reasons. I like the fact that it's both an advantage to the Arcadia Project in certain ways, but also a disadvantage. So it's not just like this happenstance made her have a superpower. It's this gave her an interesting, different way of interacting with the world, but it doesn't always turn out to be good. So I liked that, and I thought it was complex, but I also wondered, like, which came first? Did you decide to have her have that fall and have that specific backstory before you decided to have her bones being full of metal being something that would make everything different? Or did you come up with the idea of, like, well, maybe if this person was full of metal, and then that's how it could possibly happen?
I believe, and I did start this book, you know, 6 years ago, so some of the early stages of it are a little fuzzy in my mind. But I think I first knew that I wanted to write Millie, you know, as someone who had this suicide attempt. And then obviously the deciding on it being a fall came later in the process. And then as I researched how you would have to put someone back together after a fall like that, then I had the thought, oh my goodness, though, but wouldn't that make it a problem for her to interact with Faye? I already knew she was going to be interacting with Faye, but then I thought, well, if she has all this steel hardware in her body, is this going to work for my plot? Because she needs to be dealing with supernatural, you know, anti-iron sort of beings. And then I thought, well, yeah, it does make it harder, which makes it more interesting. So let's do that.
I think it works really well. There's actually a scene that actually ties in with a side character I wanted to talk about, where she, that would be Anaya, and she learns about the fairy world, which he had been ignorant of, because Fox, I believe it's Fox at one point, says, I'm a member of the fairy court, and I is rolling her eyes and saying whatever, and Fox then goes to Millie and says, oh, show her, describe my hand, Iron Bone, show her. It's just like, please, this is that malicious glee. It's like, yeah, just show her the truth.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I like that moment.
So you have a couple of characters learning about the fairy world for the first time, and they don't repeat. So that sort of experience of learning to deal with fairy, I wanted you to talk about how you came up to write Millie and Naya's sort of immersion into a world that's always been there, because the fairy had been here for who knows how long, but have always been glamored and hidden from view, and having to have that intersection for the first time.
One of my least favorite things in urban fantasy or portal fantasy or any story where the normal humdrum everyday world suddenly someone from that world becomes aware of magic or ghosts or whatever it is. My least favorite thing in these stories is always that ritual of denial that the character always has to go through, because we as the reader know that it's real. That's why we bought the book. So I always feel really frustrated having to sit through endless iterations of this same, the main character is going to come up with every way they can possibly deny this and prolong the story, you know. So I just wanted to get right into it. And that was the nice thing about having someone with borderline personality disorder, is we're so used to paradigm shifts that someone can say, oh yeah, well, everything you ever believed is wrong. And the borderline, you know, with even the slightest bit of evidence, can just go, well, all right. And that's basically what Millie does, you know. Okay, well, I've believed crazier stuff than this before, so let's go with it until I have reason to believe that he's lying. So, yeah, she just goes with it, which allowed me to just carry on with the story and not do that whole irritating denial thing that I hate. And so with Anaya, I had to obviously have a way for someone who's much more sane and centered to have no choice but to believe. And seeing is believing. And Millie was right there, so she could demonstrate. And obviously it has a much bigger shock effect on Anaya than it did on Millie. But Anaya had the advantage of having dreamed of this exact person her entire life, and now her dream is literally standing right in front of her. So that's another bit of evidence, you know, that makes it seem more instantly real to her.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Anaya was that right before that, you have it set up that she's Christian, and she's very much envisioned this person as an angel. And there's an interesting exchange that Millie and Anaya have right before they go into the fairy bar, where Anaya says that Jesus said that it was cool for her to be there. And Millie kind of looks at her like, what? And Anaya's like, you're going to throw shade on me for that? Really? And I love that.
Yeah. I love just the whole idea of what people decide is absurd and what they decide is okay. I mean, pick any person off the street, anybody, and they'll tell you how ridiculous, you know, a half dozen different beliefs are. But then if you poke at them long enough, you'll always turn up something they believe that's equally, if not more, ridiculous. So it just becomes a matter of what implausible, ridiculous things are you comfortable believing? And so, yeah, as someone who's, you know, sort of spiritual myself, though I don't belong to any particular religious denomination, I don't like the way that religious people are portrayed in a lot of science fiction and fantasy. And so I wanted to have some characters in the book who were, like myself, you know, intelligent and reasoning human beings, but who also are willing to accept the idea of something beyond what we can measure scientifically. And so, you know, I introduce someone who's a devout believer in the Christian faith, and I know that a lot of the readers are going to have an instant sort of disdain for her because of that, as Millie does. And so I had to have her make that point, you know, which is that, you know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff. Millie herself, which Anaya doesn't even know yet, Millie has already accepted the existence of fairies and magic and whatnot, and yet she's judging Anaya for being Christian. So, yeah, I have some fun with that, and quite a bit more fun with it in the next book as well.
So I wanted to ask, maybe this is more revealed in the second book, but I'm always interested in world building, and we talked a little about Carol and her magic. So I was curious about how you structured basically the Arcadia Project as an organization, even beyond the Los Angeles branch, because as I was reading this, I kept thinking of Men in Black for some reason.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, this is just the Los Angeles branch, but there's going to be there's other parts to that, dealing with fairies across the earth. So I was curious at how you came to structure the organization and how big it actually really is. We only get the barest hints of that.
Yeah, I can give you a little taste of that without spoiling too much of what happens in the next book. The central headquarters are in London, always have been since like the Renaissance times, though the project has gone through several iterations and rebirths over history. But it's central headquarters is in London, but there are three main offices in the U.S. There are also offices in Helsinki, Finland, Nairobi, Kenya, just places all over, Singapore. I name some of the specific locations in the second book. There used to be a location in St. Petersburg, but during the Russian Revolution, everything fell apart there. And that has some repercussions that pop up in the second book. But yeah, so it is a worldwide organization, and there's offices in the U.S. in L.A., in New York, and in New Orleans. And New Orleans is the central U.S. office. So Carol's boss is located in New Orleans, and we meet him next book.
Now, you could have gone with a national approach or a government agency, which is one of the stereotypes. But here you went with a multinational, almost what's the phrase I'm looking for? Almost like a NGO in some ways. And so I was curious why you developed it along those lines.
Well, it couldn't be a national organization because we're dealing with an entire world. I mean, it's a parallel world, and it intersects with our world everywhere, and not just in, say, the United States. So while the U.S. government is involved in the Arcadia Project, each area of the world has to figure out how they're going to structure themselves on a case-by-case basis. They're dealing with aliens, but they also have to deal with their own government. And depending on the government, the structure might be very different. In the U.S., they just have kind of a mole in the Department of Homeland Security, who kind of make sure that everything goes smoothly for them. But in the other countries, it might be a very different situation.
So I know you don't want to spoil the next book for us, but can you give us a taste of what it's going to be about? And also, when is it coming out?
I'm assuming March of 2017. I'm assuming they're going to be spaced a year apart. There's three books for sure, probably more. I can certainly write more. So it'll probably be March of 2017, and it is, since we're in spoiler zone, I can say that, yeah, the inciting incident of that book is that Millie goes to Soundstage 13 in an attempt to kind of just wrap things up with Carol and make sure everything's safe for them to proceed with using the soundstage as a soundstage again. And while she's there, she sees what appears to be Teo's ghost. Which, the problem with that is that ghosts are not supposed to be real. Like, even the Arcadia Project says, yeah, there's no such thing as ghosts, but Millie sees what appears to be one. So the book kind of sparks off from there of the investigation of what did I actually just see, and why, and what is it doing here?
Excellent. I'm sure Julie will join me in saying that we're looking forward to that very much.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It's really a wild ride. I'm so proud of the second book. Like, it's just, yeah. If you like Borderline, you're going to absolutely love it, because it's like everything about Borderline except turned up to 11. It's wonderful.
So is the second book also from Millie's point of view, or do you switch character point of views?
Yes, Millie, the first three books at least, and probably thereafter, but definitely the first three books are a very tight first-person point of view of Millie's. But if anybody wants to go to my website and sign up for my email newsletter, I am, with each little newsletter I send out, I'm going to be sending out little vignettes that I wrote from the POV of other Arcadia Project characters. For example, the first one is going to be from Gloria's point of view. It's a little vignette called God Doesn't Make Mistakes. And it's Gloria talking to us and explaining a little bit about what led her to do what she did that got her sentenced to life in the Arcadia Project.
So, yeah, tell us a little bit, because we are deep into spoiler territory, and I'm really curious to hear a little bit more about the residents in Residence 4 who Millie lives with for a very brief period of time before everything catastrophically explodes. And by everything, I mean possibly Millie. Because we only see them through Millie's eyes, and we know that in the Arcadia Project, no one is supposed to ask anyone about their personal stuff. It's clear that they've all got things that they're struggling with, and also you're not supposed to ask them about it. How did you go about writing them? And tell us a little bit more about those characters, the specific characters that you created, and why.
Yeah. Again, since some of this is way back in the mists of before my functioning memory, I'm not entirely sure where some of them came from, like as far as the very germ of inspiration or whatever. But I can tell you a little bit more about them. Gloria has been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. She's very high functioning, and most people wouldn't really notice there was anything wrong with her, but she has some strong narcissistic tendencies. And yeah, she did kill two people in a fit of rage, which she will detail in my little newsletter vignette. Tuan has a history of what they believed to be schizophrenia, but it did not respond to medication at all. They administered electroconvulsive therapy, which seemed to get rid of the voices in his head, and he's been pretty much fine ever since then, except for a touch of paranoia, which is evident in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also a big-time screenwriter. He had a couple of major feature films and also worked on staff and a couple of television shows, and his career was devastated because he developed these symptoms of schizophrenia while he was working on the staff of a television show. And very visibly, as his coworkers would have said, went crazy just in front of everyone. So he's got some, you know, issues around that, and is not a very happy guy at the time that we meet him. Let's see, who else? Song, we know she had a fling with a fae and got pregnant, and that's how she came to be with the Arcadia Project, because you can't really raise a changeling baby out in the wild world by yourself. Who else am I leaving out? Teo. Yeah, undocumented birth. His mother was of the particularly intolerant sort, who had no sympathy whatsoever for his mental health issues and decided he was possessed by demons, and so was very emotionally abusive, maybe even occasionally physically abusive, trying to get the demons out of him. And so he ran away, and that was how the Arcadia Project found him. And I think that covers everybody, just about.
It's quite a cast of characters.
It's a really fascinating group, and it's really interesting to see the way that they interact with each other. I hope that we'll get to see more of that in the coming books.
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Well, I feel like we've been talking for about an hour now, and we should probably wrap up. But before we do, do you want to tell us where we can find... You mentioned your website that has some other vignettes. Where is your website, and where can we find more of you online and your work in the world?
Oh, yes. My website is just michellebaker.com, M-I-S-H-E-L-L baker.com. No spaces, no dashes, anything. Very easy. My Twitter handle is also just Michelle Baker, and I am when I'm not out of town, and sometimes even when I am, I'm very active on Twitter. I love interacting with people. I treat it just sort of like my office water cooler. So you'll often find me there procrastinating and chatting. So I'm very easy to find on Twitter. I'm also on Facebook, though I'm not quite as active there. And I also love receiving handwritten letters by regular snail mail. My mailing address is on my website for anybody who likes writing and receiving letters, because I do reply to every single one. So
she really does.
Even outside of...
Yeah.
Even outside of letter writing.
Yeah, every month.
Yeah, she really does. I also like to do handwritten letters, and Michelle is one of my best correspondents. So if you write her a letter, she'll probably write you back.
Yes.
No one can read my handwriting. I just print them out and send photos and things. It works for me.
My handwriting's a work in progress.
Oh, your handwriting is great. It's perfectly legible.
Thank you.
Yes. It's not the doctor weird glyphs that mine is.
Well, that's okay. You take gorgeous pictures, Paul, so that makes up for it.
Thank you.
So Michelle Baker, follow her on Twitter, go to her website, read Gloria's vignette. I'm going to do that as soon as we end this call. And definitely go and buy Borderline, because it's a really good book. And we all talked about it being difficult to read. It is difficult to read, especially if you have experience with mental illness and stuff, and it might send you into like echoes of your own experience or experience with loved ones. But it's also really fun and fast to read. So it's kind of got two different levels going on. It's a really fun, fast fantasy read on another level. And I think that if you enjoy fun, fast urban fantasy, especially, you would probably really enjoy this book.
It has a beautiful cover.
Gorgeous cover.
It does have a beautiful cover.
Michael McCartney. He's a genius.
I was about to ask who did it. You supplied for us. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Michelle. It has been great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks, Paul, for asking all sorts of awesome questions.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to Michelle.
Yes, it was. And with that, we're going to wrap up. So see everybody next time.
Stay frosty.
Our intro and outro music comes from Nocturnia by Psychedelic Pedestrian. You can find out more about them on freemusicarchive.org, including the full version of the song. We obviously made some edits to the song, including sound effects and, of course, shortening the length. You can also support us by going to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to send us a suggestion, you can do so at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, skiffyandfanty.com, and check out the little suggested topic form at the top there. You can also just send us emails. You can also find us on Twitter at skiffyandfanty or on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Just search for us on there. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next time.